It's into the Harper edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, we take another look at the lies, misdemeanors, and crimes that the Harper government has committed in this lead-up to the 2015 election. So let's begin episode 284.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Well, I said a couple of shows back that there's an important election happening this year. During that show, I debunked the myth that conservatives are better managers of the public purse or that they're fiscally conservative at all. I also covered a number of their other sins, such as the CRA shakedown of charities, overpaying for Arctic ships, overpaying for jet fighters, militarization of Canada's image, advertising on phantom or terminated programs, the temporary foreign workers program, muzzling of scientists, defunding of science, gutting library and archives of Canada, closing DFO research libraries, radical reduction of environmental protections, billions of dollars in subsidies for big oil, bad treaties with China and the TPP, killing of the Canadian Wheat Board, trying to kill off the CBC and Canada Post, abolishing the mandatory long-form census, hypocrisy of reducing the debt and the deficit, failing budget forecasting, and pandas. Enough said. I spent the whole hour on that, and yet I didn't even get halfway through my list. So this week will be part two of who knows how many segments in support of the Anyone But Conservatives campaign. As much as I like to take credit for this crusade, let me share with you, my loyal listeners, that this campaign was a brainchild originally of Danny Williams in Newfoundland regarding a broken promise by Harper involving equalization payments. And of late, it's the brainchild of frustrated veterans, along with the Union of Federal Scientists, the Professional Institute of Public Service of Canada, or PIPSC. Why would PIPSC join such a campaign? Well, as I said last week, it was the muzzling of scientists, well, honestly, all civil servants, and those who are paid from the public purse. Coupled with the aggressive defunding of all science that does not in some way benefit corporations, well, that's their reasoning. Why the vets? Well, again, this was covered last week by our Prairie correspondents, but a quick review. The government's attitude towards vets, resulting eventually in the demotion of one of its ministers, an attitude reflected in an encounter between a spouse of one suffering vet and the Minister of Veteran Affairs, then Julian Fentino. Well, let's listen again, and a warning. This contains subject matter that may be offensive to patriotic and caring individuals.
I'm just a vet spouse. You're forgetting us. Once more. We're nothing to you. Again.
Add to this neglect the new Veterans Charter that was imposed by the government, which substantially reduced injured vets' benefits. Harper is quick to wrap himself in military colors when there are votes to be got. But when it comes to things like providing support at home, well, he's very Cheshire Cat at those times. He makes no friends with vets when it came out recently that the government is currently fighting a lawsuit by Afghan vets over the reduction of pension benefits that the Harper-supported New Veterans Charter imposed. This fight has cost to date $700,000. Now don't get me wrong, the government should defend itself in court when challenged. This is not the issue here. It is the fact that the Conservatives thrust vets out front and center for photo ops, pledged loyalty and support when they expected to go in and do battle. And yet when it comes time to help these very people when they come back injured and damaged, the Harper Conservative government is spending $700,000 to fight these soldiers who fought for us, for Canada. Well, seems to Harper it's more important to give out tax breaks to rich kids to go to hockey camp than suicide prevention for PTSD soldiers. He has offended many vets by misleading claims his government has made. Most aggravating was the announcement that, and this part was stated loudly, the government was spending an additional $50 million on psychiatric support for vets. And then, in a hardly audible whisper, it added that this money was to be spread out over a decade. That's nothing. It's a pittance. Coupled with the discovery that when the government pledges to spend money, it seems to have a long track record of not actually spending the money. And in the end, the pledge is returned to the government coffers unspent, late at night, in the dark, and as stealthily as possible. Fortunately, some people stay up late and find this stuff out. As an example, it was discovered that the much-pilloried Veteran Affairs was far from short of money to meet the needs of soldiers. The department was so awash with funds that the government was refunded over $1 billion that Veterans Affairs failed to spend. Why was there $1 billion returned? Because the money promised to vets was simulated money, not tangible money. A lot of this government's money is simulated. Like our Harper Conservative government is a simulated democracy. It's not really governing democratically, it's playing games at our expense. Data tabled at the House in response to a written request shows roughly one-third of the so-called lapsed funds were handed back between 2005 and 2013 budget years when the government was engaged in massive deficit cutting. Well, Harper had promised a balanced budget, and we knew someone would have to pay for it. I guess Harper thought vets were the best target. They're likely to vote conservative anyway. Military types tend to be small-c conservatives by nature, and because they're so underpaid, they are less likely to have surplus cash to donate to the conservative election campaign. So they're not high on the Harper re-election priorities, except for those photo ops, of course. And a short interjection here about the insanity of conservative voters. I chronicled on the show here about a fight in my birthriding of Brandon Souris, where some locals thought Harper manipulated the candidate process in a by-election so egregiously they mounted a strong campaign to dump Harper's puppet, choice for candidate, and elect anyone else. I should note, traditionally the vote is between the Conservatives, who tend to get about 60% of the vote, and the NDP, who get the other 30-ish percent. There's always some fringe voters out there who vote Liberal or Green to sort of round out the percentage. Well, in this campaign, to show Harper that he could not be a dictator, that even conservatives have lines that should not be crossed, well, what happened? Well, the NDP dropped to less than 10%. The Liberals, who received the most not Harper support, gathered 40%, while the Harper minions still got 45%. And after a brief kerfuffle, all seems forgotten. Hail Harper! The point being that in some parts of the country, they would prefer a proto-fascist regime than anything else. So brainwashed are they against the NDP or the Liberals. The cons could run a cabbage patch with a hat on and still win. So, getting back to the deep budget cuts of the Harper government to Veteran Affairs. The Conservatives often trumpet how much the budget for Veteran Affairs has gone up under their watch. Right now, it's about $3.4 billion a year, up from $2.8 billion when the Tories took office. What they don't say is that anywhere between 4.7 and 8.2% of that total allocation has been allowed to lapse because of the department's inability or reluctance to spend it all. So that means the actual increase drops from 600,000 to half that much. And that sounds like a lot of money. Well, there are two things not mentioned when they use raw numbers as opposed to relative numbers. So the budget increased. Good. But those numbers are not inflation adjusted. When we factor in for an inflation rate of 1.7%, that still gives an increase of about $100 million or 5%. Still sounds good. But then we need to remember that we have been at war for all that time. So the number of soldiers who need to be helped has increased by about 40,000 over the 12 years of war. So the effective operating budget has actually been cut by 11%. That's why they had to close 9 regional offices and cut 450 staff. Harper supports our troops? Bullshit. And it's just not vets who have been victims of this bait and switch. It is reported that over the last 2 fiscal years, all federal departments allowed more than $18 billion in budgeted funding to lapse, according to public account figures released at the end of October of 2014. Foreign aid left about 10% of its budget unspent. And then you have hundreds of millions earmarked for green initiatives, research into the environmental impact of the fossil fuel industry, climate change adaptation, sustainability forestry practices, and many others. They did manage to find a few tens of millions to support oil and gas industry through research and marketing development. So the money's there when you want it, but, you know, there seems to be a slight ideological tint to all this, or maybe it's just me. Maybe now is a good time to sort of take a break and reflect on what we've done. So we'll be back after this break.
Join Team PowerSmart. Set an energy conservation target of 10%. You'll get access to tools to help you conserve, and you can track your progress online. Visit bchydro.com/Team PowerSmart to join today. This message brought to you by BC Hydro PowerSmart and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
And we're back. So, what else can I say? Sadly, there are so many contentious issues we can talk about. Let's strike at the heart of the Harper conservative hypocrisy. Harper is supposed to be a victims' rights advocate. Screw criminals! We need to support the victim! But how does he do this? He enacts a victim fund to be paid for by hoisting special fees on the convicted. A very unreliable source of money, because most convicts, well, they don't have any money to pay these fees in the first place. So no money is forthcoming from this source, means no compensation for the victims. Simultaneously, because the government says, hey, these fines will bring in extra money, it actually reduces reliable funding in the way of cutbacks to federally funded initiatives. Just think about that. And let's not forget that Harper has a list of enemies, something we learned when the newly shuffled conservative ministers received a list of people to be treated as hostiles. Noticeably, the list contained a lot of civil servants. This is Nixon-esque in nature, but it does jive with the fact that Nixon had the FBI go after people on his enemies list, and as I mentioned last time, Harper seems to have sicked Revenue Canada on those who have dared criticized Herr Harper. To be on Harper's bad side can prove fatal. Remember when the National Roundtable on the Economy and Environment, an independent government agency, well, they recommended a carbon tax despite the government's opposition. Well, mysteriously, it found itself on next budget's cutting block. Harper doesn't tolerate opposing ideas well, if at all, as becomes evident as we do a roll call of those he has publicly attacked. He attacked Sheila Fraser, the former Auditor General, the person responsible for ensuring of the accountability of government by performing audits on various departments and projects. The AG is responsible not to the government, but to Parliament as a whole. This fact means that the AG is not the puppet of the government, and as such, the AG has run afoul of our supreme ruler when facts that are uncomfortable for his regime are brought to light. Fraser exposed the boondoggle that was the G20 G8 summit in Toronto in 2010. More recently, she was the target of the cons when she spoke out in regards to the Unfair Election Act that was thrust upon us last year. Once the darling of the Conservatives, when she brought down the Liberal government over the sponsorship scandal, it seems it was not the truth that the Conservatives were praising, but the political opportunism. When the facts cast a Machiavellian glow on the Harper government, suddenly she was a partisan and ill-informed. Then, as a counter to the Auditor General, Harper created the Parliamentary Budget Office, doing ostensibly the same job as the AG. Okay, not really. So let's get a little technical, just before someone writes in and says, hey Don, you got it wrong. Parliamentary Budget Officer provides independent analysis of the Canadian Parliament on the state of the nation's finances, the government's estimates, and trends in the Canadian economy. And upon request from a committee or parliamentarian, estimates the financial cost of any proposal for matters over which the Parliament has jurisdiction. The role of the Auditor General of Canada is to aid accountability by conducting independent audits of the federal government's operations. The Auditor General reports to the House of Commons, not to the government. These audits provide members of Parliament with objective information to help them examine the government's activities and hold them to account. Okay, from that, there is one important difference between the two posts. One, the AG is responsible to ensure spent money was spent well. Well, the PBO ensures that planned spending is, well, planned well. In this job, Harper tasked longtime party stalwart Kevin Page. Unfortunately, some people in office claim to have a moral base, and some people actually believe them. So when Harper stated that the purpose of this position was to ensure government costing was accurate, we here in BC remember the Fudget budget. Well, Page misunderstood and assumed when Harper said government, he meant all government, and not just non-conservative governments. Well, the relationship between Page and Harper quickly turned frosty when Page announced the government lied. Okay, well, he didn't actually say lied. That's a bit too harsh. I think it was more something like underreported the cost of the F-35 fighters. He then repeated the sin when he questioned why the Harper conservative government was spending billions more on prisons and the legal system while crime rates were falling. So while crime rates has dropped by about 23% since conservatives took office, spending on criminal justice system inversely increased by 23%. Side note, the crime rate has not lowered because more people are being arrested. The population is rising because criminals are being sentenced to longer sentences. And leading research south of the border places only about a quarter of the drop in crime due to locking up people longer. Many theories as to why the drop point to the availability of abortion, lead paint, leaded gas, and an increase in overall education levels. Another way the PBO upset Harper was over their plans to repeal, well, roll back old age security. The PBO released an analysis of the projected cost over the next 7 years of benefits to the elderly. It concluded that those costs would rise from a number of years relative to GDP and then fall back very close to current levels, slightly less than 15% of the total federal programming spending. This report contradicted the government statement that old age security was unsustainable. Page was so committed to open government, unlike his former friend Harper, he even took the government to court for the release of financial documents some departments refused to submit. The issue at hand was Harper had promised an austerity budget with set numbers for cutbacks, but when the Page asked to see the specific cuts, to see if the smoke matched the fire, well, Harper now had a majority, so transparency was not a high priority, and a number of large and key departments refused to comply with Page's request. Ergo, he took them to court. It is interesting to note that Harper did not renew the tenure of Page, and instead of replacing him with someone with experience in budgets and auditing, he instead chose a librarian. Even when the pettiness shows, the Harper government is ever willing to lower the bar. You will think that it's a no-brainer that when the person responsible for nuclear safety in Canada, in this case the nuclear regulator Linda Keen, formerly the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission president, had the audacity to close a nuclear power plant because it failed to live up to licensing agreements. Specifically, it failed to install backup generators, which if not implemented could, under emergency conditions, result in a cooling system failing. Holy smokes, Backman, our very own Chernobyl. Of course, the chill effect, the crime committed, was not a disagreement over policy, but the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission is an arm's-length regulatory body intended to remove politics from decision-making. Harper, throughout this independence, when he stood up in Parliament and decried that this, quote, liberal appointee was risking the lives of Canadians. I should pause here. The risk he was speaking of is the reactor in question responsible for producing about two-thirds of the medical radioactive isotopes used in the world to diagnose and treat various conditions. Anyway, the point of bodies like the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission is to put the interest of the nation first, of the people first, and not those of the current government or its political machinations. It is interesting to note that this incident occurred while the Harper government was attempting to sell another national crown jewel, CANDU, the part of Atomic Canada that designs and builds nuclear reactors. So when the Natural Resource Minister Gary Lunn threatened to fire the head of the commission if they did not reverse their decision to close the reactor, well, the commissioner called for a public inquiry into the political meddling by the ruling conservatives into the agency's independency. The incident ultimately culminated with Ms. Keen being forced to step down as president of the commission, a win for the bad guys. A quote from one commentator on the incident, "They aren't just telling public servants to move, they're telling them to get in and move in my direction. This is a government that only wants to see and hear what it wants to see and hear, and if you get in their way, watch out." And of course, the smear list goes all the way to the top judge of the land. Now, to be fair, Harper has not had his best luck with the Supreme Court of Canada. I would say because he continues to implement authoritarian dictatorial laws, but nonetheless, he has lost a great many cases before the Supreme Court. He lost an attempt to close the safe injection site here in Vancouver. He lost in the repeal of the prostitution laws, which set up another loss when the replacement legislation will also fail at the Supreme Court because it essentially is the same law that was just struck down. But more on that lately. There was a striking down of mandatory minimum sentences. Then the court reversed the retroactive elimination of early parole for nonviolent offenders. They restored extra credit for time served for prisoners spent incarcerated prior to conviction. It ruled that Harper government had to follow the Constitution when it came to changing or abolishing the Senate. That is, it needed the consent of the province. It upheld our privacy rights by rejecting the conservatives' attempt to acquire data about us from telecoms and ISPs without a warrant. And of course, the one straw too many for Harper. The rejection of Mark Nadon as Harper's appointee to the Supreme Court for failing to qualify for the position. In the last case, Harper came out and alleged the Chief Justice improperly contacted the government in July 2013 to lobby against the appointment of Federal Court of Appeals Judge Nadon to the Supreme Court. The Prime Minister's office made the claim almost as innuendo. The PMO issued a statement saying, McKay informed Prime Minister Stephen Harper that taking a call from Chief Justice would be inadvisable and inappropriate. The Prime Minister agreed and did not take the call. Now, the PMO did not actually say that Chief Justice, Beverly McLaughlin, asked to speak to Harper. In fact, Harper failed to mention that the Chief Justice was consulted by the Parliamentary Committee and the then Justice Minister, McKay. These people are the ones who screen proposed new judges and seek advice on the needs of the top court. And that she merely flagged the issue of appointing a federal court judge as opposed to a Quebec court judge as required by the Constitution. And this was long before the appointment was made and long before Nadon's appointment was actually challenged. Let's say that again. It was the government officials that reached out to Chief Justice. McLaughlin never made any attempt to call or contact the MP at all. And if a call was made to McKay, it was simply returning his call, his request for input. So the PMO, well, Harper, actively attempted to mislead Canadians about the events in an aggressive attempt to smear the head of the judiciary branch of government, the one institution in this nation that acts as a counterbalance to the near dictatorship that has become the executive branch, which has itself dominated the legislative branch. What's that you're saying, Don? What does that have to do with anything? Well, you see, modern democracies are based on a check and balance system. It's seen most starkly in the US, but it exists in most democracies to varying degrees. The idea is that you have three co-equal branches of government that ensure that no one branch becomes too dominant and thus threatens the freedoms and democracies of the nation. The three branches are the legislative branch. This is the one that is in charge of enacting legislation and is universally directly elected by the people. Then you have the executive branch. This branch's function is to actually implement the laws passed by the former branch. The lockstone of the governmental triumvirate is the judiciary, whose job is to ensure that the laws passed are coherent and that the application of those laws comply with the Constitution. As an example, the legislative branch, in other words Parliament, passes a law to prevent terrorism from operating in Canada by tracking their activities on the internet. The executive branch, in the US this would be the president, but here in Canada it's the PMO that has accrued this sort of role. They actually task CSIS to record all electronic communications from every Canadian. It would then be the role of the judiciary branch to judge if the law is implemented with both legally coherent and it's constitutionally valid, which it's likely to say no in this example because it violates our rights of privacy. The judiciary actually has two roles in Canada. One, the government can ask the court if proposed legislation is legally consistent. This is called a reference question. This is what the government did when it asked if it had the powers to unilaterally change the Senate. There was no actual law before the court, but the question was, if we passed a law, do you think it would be constitutional? And the reference questions are almost always exclusively constitutional in nature. The second is when a plaintiff sues the government, and this case is eventually appealed to the court. The court will then rule on the legality and constitutionality of the legal ruling and, when warranted, the validity of the law. In neither case can the judiciary branch initiate action. It can only react to others' request. In this way, to make the claim that the Chief Justice was interfering with government business is anathema to its role and a direct challenge to the very heart of our democracy. Fortunately, the PM received almost universal condemnation for this obvious bullying, including the former Conservative Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. but it does speak volumes to the depths this regime is willing to go to forward its radical agenda and to what lengths it's willing to punish those who dare interfere with those plans. Okay, I think it's time for another moment to calm down a little bit, so we'll return after this break.
This is the sound of compost and recyclables going into the garbage. Garbage that ends up in the landfill creating greenhouse gases. This is the sound of a more sustainable campus. You can make a difference when you sort it out. Learn more at sustain.ubc.ca/sortitout.
And we're back. Okay, so let's follow a different line of evidence that the current government is not only harmful, but it's also criminal. Now, I'm going to start this piece with a bit of a contradiction of sorts. I want to say the corporate conservatives are incompetent. And in one dimension, this is very true. I've already talked about the various ways they've mangled the economy, misspent money, hypocrisy on the deficit, attacks on science and the civil servants, crushing political dissent, and more. But they're still leading in the polls. They're incompetent, and yet Machiavellian in other ways. And this leads nicely into our next topic. We have yet to talk about the illegal activities the Harper Conservatives have been caught or implicated in. So let's start. Illegal campaign funding is a good place to begin. There was the In-N-Out scandal. This was one element that precipitated Harper's first election win in 2006. You see, this is a way of getting around campaign spending limits. A restriction on campaign spending is one of the pillars that ensures fair and democratic elections, unlike the $1 one vote the U.S. has pursued. So once the National Party had reached its spending limit, it would transfer money in to local writing accounts, ostensibly allowing them to use it for their local campaigns. But instead, as soon as the money arrived, it was then transferred out of the writing to pay for advertising. Advertising that was identical to the national ads, but changed the attribution from paid for by the Conservative Party of Canada to paid for the campaign to elect Joe Schmo. When investigated by Elections Canada, many riding organizations were a tad honest and basically said that it was equivalent to money laundering. Wait, there's more. Not only was this an attempt to circumvent spending limits, something the Liberal Martin government was attempting to make illegal prior to the loss in 2006, but the Conservative Party tried to claim almost $1 million refund from Elections Canada for this jiggery pokery. You see, another part of campaign spending regulations means that party can claim a refund or, more appropriately, a reimbursement of campaign spending. Again, this helps level the economic playing field for parties. Remember, the Conservatives were still a minority government, and this issue brought Parliament to a halt in what Harper called the tyranny of the majority. Tyranny of the majority, he does know what democracy is, right? Anyhow, because the other parties had the temerity to want to investigate the illegal activities of the Conservatives, heaven forbid. Under growing pressure and learning a lesson from the Liberals that allowed investigations into wrongdoing often is politically fatal, re-sponsorship scandal, Harper called a snap election in 2008 before too much could be made public. Oh, and yes, just to add a dollop of irony and hypocrisy, this was 18 months after Harper passed a law fixing the election date to prevent political manipulation of elections. Like he just did. How does the man live with himself? Well, as the In-N-Out money may not have been strictly speaking illegal, they were definitely not eligible for reimbursements, as the Conservative Party had attempted to do, even threatening to sue Elections Canada. Well, that turned out to be the wrong move, because in February 24th of 2011, four senior Conservative Party members were charged in the In-N-Out scandal under the Elections Canada Act, with overspending over $1 million in the 2006 election campaign, including allegations that Conservative election expense documents submitted to Elections Canada were false or misleading, and attempted to fraudulently gain almost $1 million in refunds from taxpayers. This ended up with charges being dropped as part of a plea deal which saw the Conservative Party plead guilty over the In-N-Out scandal, agreeing to repay over $200,000 for its role in the scheme. And yet they won a majority in 2011. We are the stupidest people in the world when it comes to voting, people. Wise up. And of course, we should remember that one of Harper's minions, Bev Oda, was caught lying to Parliament. When she first stated that cutting funding to Kairos was recommended by civil servants because the group no longer qualified for funding. However, it was later revealed that this was a blatant lie and that she personally directed the funding to be cut as political payback. If you remember on our previous show, Kairos had the audacity of supporting the Palestinian movement against the hyper-pro-Israel Harper government. This was going to lead to a contempt of parliament vote, but Harper's government was itself found to be in contempt of parliament, triggering the 2011 election. The Commons Procedure and House Affairs Committee recommended the House find the Conservative government in contempt for refusing to disclose adequate information about the cost of several big-ticket items. These were documents pertaining to the price tag for Harper's Law and Order agenda, think building more prisons and mandatory sentencing, as well as corporate tax cuts and the plans to buy stealth combat jets. Requests for details of proposed bills and their cost estimates only found the government had been dragging its heels since the fall of 2010, almost a year. It seems that Harper felt it was accountable to no one, but this was a minority government, and the other parties felt, as is proper, that the government should be accountable not only to Herr Harper, but to the parliament as a whole, the people's representative. When forced to be the open government he campaigned to be previously as opposition leader, well, once PM, that promise seemed whimsical. In response to being found in contempt of parliament on March 25th, 2011, a motion of non-confidence was introduced to the House. Members of parliament voted on this motion, declaring a lack of confidence by a vote of 156 to 145 and forcing an election. This contempt finding is unique in Canadian history. In fact, in a wider context, it is the first time that a government in the 54-member Commonwealth of Nations, Commonwealth Realm, or Parliamentary Republic alike had been found in contempt of Parliament. Yay, I mean boo, Canada! And again, in a spectacular example of incompetence of the Canadian voter, how did we punish the Conservatives? What punishment was dealt out for the arrogant, undemocratic, authoritarian activity? Well, two of the opposition parties, the Liberals and the Bloc, were essentially wiped out. And what happened to the Cons? Well, it seems that crime does pay because they finally achieved the majority in the 2011 election. I can only assume that the population of this great nation were so ill-informed, apathetic, that this atrocity happened. And that's one of the missions of this year's show, is to ensure that you are not only informed and educated, but spurred on to take action. How can we allow such activities to continue and still think ourselves free and democratic? Kevin Page had a great description for Harper's rule as Putin-esque. Oh, but we're not done yet. There's more illegal activity to remember. As I said, 2011 saw the Cons gain a majority. One thing that had facilitated this outcome was the illegal and systematic deception of non-conservative voters who were told to go to non-existent voting stations. One can assume an attempt to reduce the turnout and thus improve the chances of conservative candidates winning. You might remember this as the robocall scandal. The most amazing thing about the robocall scandal is that it became apparent early on that the conservative voter database was used to perpetrate this crime. And yet after repeated requests from Elections Canada for information to help track down the wrongdoer, the Conservative Party stonewalled at every step. All the while it was obstructing the investigation, the Harperites were publicly saying that they wanted to get to the bottom of this and expunge the reputation of the Conservative Party. As it was, one minor party minion has taken the fall for the scandal, but considering the large scope of the attack on our democracy, it seems unlikely such a minor player could have perpetrated this crime on his own. And there is still the question as to how he gained access to the Conservative database, and more importantly, what mechanisms, of which there were none, were implemented to prevent such an event in the future. Because, well, honestly, I think the Cons were not completely unpleased with what had happened. Then, of course, there was the Senate scandal. And to be fair, this, in and of itself, I blame Harper no more than any other partisan political leader, although most of those caught up with either not meeting resident requirements to be a senator, or those who made illegal expense claims were mostly conservative, well, that shows poor judgment on the PM's part, and that's not uniquely a Harper-esque thing. No, it's not the Senate scandal that may bring down the House of Harper, but the scandal that it gave birth to, the Duffy Affair. For those who don't remember, one of the fallouts of the Senate scandal was a number of senators required to pay back inappropriate expense claims. In the case of one senator, Mike Duffy, the amount was about $90,000. This was money apparently that Duffy didn't actually have. Well, at first it came out that the party was spending several thousands of dollars paying Duffy's legal fees. No problem there. But when Duffy demanded the party pony up for the bucks for the repayment, well, the party said no. This led to a period where Duffy implied that if this bill was not paid, that he would go public with party secrets, something I'm personally still waiting for. Well, when the party failed to make the payments, it seems that the PM's then chief of staff, Nigel Wright, wrote a personal check for the amount with the understanding that the Senate committee investigating the incident would give Duffy a pass, or will at least not be as harsh on him. This, of course, as I am sure a number of my listeners have already guessed, is what you would call a political bribe. Literally, money was exchanged for political favors. This is now being investigated by the RCMP, and Duffy is facing 31 charges, including bribery. Nigel Wright has yet to be brought up on charges, but it's early days. Of course, it has been said, and this is what the PMO is claiming, that Harper knew nothing about this check, nor what was going on. First, the fact that Harper is infamous as a micromanager, well, it stretches credibility to imply that he was unaware of his own chief of staff was making this bribe. There's also evidence where their own documents point that the PM, quote, signed off on the deal, although the wording was deal without any specifics, so there is wiggle room, but the alternative is no better for Harper. If he was unaware of what was happening in the PMO, remember, PMO is Prime Minister's office, so he didn't know what was going on in his own office? Well, that makes him incompetent at the very least. Lastly, there is the complete disregard for the whole segment of society. When the Supreme Court struck down Canada's prostitution law, stating that it put women at risk and that it was a violation of sex workers' constitutional rights, well, Harper et al. Promptly introduced legislation that implemented the same law that was just struck down. All the elements that put workers' lives at risk in the original bill were to be found, with slight rewording, in the new bill. And when asked about the large number of Indigenous women that have been killed, well, Harper's rebuke was to accuse people like Trudeau of committing acts of social science. That no one was singling out Native women, they were just women who happened to be Native. And as such, the current approach was sufficient in spite of the evidence otherwise. And if you need evidence of the callousness of this man, when asked how important the issue was to the government, the bastard said, it's really isn't high on our radar, to be honest. Our minister would continue to dialogue with those concerned about this. So, I mean, at least he's honest and said he didn't really care. And I've actually kind of envisioned two basic conservative conversations that go on. One with the 1% or big oil. I suspect that that kind of conversation would go something like this. So, how much did you donate? Oh, yes? Well, we have money to spend on that thing. Sorry, how much was that? Oh, well, it's top priority. That's the one. As for the rest of us, the chat would be fairly brief and sound more something like, so, how much did you donate? Oh, no, nothing? Well, we don't really have any time to really spend on that issue. Oh, sorry, what, you voted for them? Well, I don't really see that ever being a priority of our party. Kind of tells you, you know, money talks. There was a case that in an effort to eliminate government oversight via cutbacks, Harper subjected Canadians to unsafe food. What do I mean? Well, let us remember in 2012, XL Meats was closed down due to a widespread distribution of E. coli-laced meats throughout Alberta. Why did this happen? Well, the agency that is responsible for the safety of our food, well, they were subject to continual cutbacks, meaning there were reductions in staffing and testing, and thus they literally did not have enough people to inspect our food, and mass poisoning was the result. In the same vein of reducing government to the size that can be drowned in the bathtub, alike from infamous Grover Norquist and a philosophy shared by Herr Harper, between 2012 and 2016, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency has had staff reductions of 20%, same for Aboriginal Affairs. Library and Archives of Canada reduced by 23%. Human Resource and Skills Development, 24%. Environmental Assessment Agency, 34%. StatsCan, 35%. Canadian Northern Economic Development Agency was cut in half. Even Correction Services of Canada was cut by 11%. And yet, I thought Harper said that there was an avalanche of crime and we need to invest more in prisons. I guess they'll construct the buildings and the inmates can guard themselves. And yet there's always seems to be money for tax cuts for corporations, rebates for the wealthy, and of course, there's no subsidy too big for big oil. Another example of this legislative bullying that is just now common practice with this party was made evident when the Harper government attempted to pass a very flawed cybersecurity bill. And when people criticized it, the minister responsible, Vic Taves, given talking points from the PM, as are all ministers and MPs, said you were either with us or the pedophiles. And this is such a telling line. In the world of Harper, there's only the right that controls the truth. Harper's view of the world. And if you don't agree, attempt to criticize or provide feedback, you're a traitor, an enemy of the state, a criminal. So on that note, we're going to take one more break, and we'll be back after this, assuming you haven't been arrested by Herr Harper.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
And we're back. Well, I'm going to close the show with playing a clip from a previous episode about the Unfair Election Act. This is a law that so changed our voting laws, so skewed things in the Conservatives' favor, well, the fix may be in, folks. But only you and I can stop it from happening. Remember, 2015, never forget, there will be a reckoning. I've talked in the past about the Unfair Election Act that is currently being shoved down the throats of Canadians. Spoiler alert, I'm not a fan. Well, it seems I'm in good company. In an open letter to Imperial Harper, a group of global experts on elections made it clear that this would be a step backwards and can seriously undermine our elections process. One of the big issues is the lack of consultation. You would think that such a major alteration of the foundation of democracy would benefit from a plurality of political players, that is, all parties, of which no consultation was acquired, or election academics, of which none were consulted. In fact, even the sort of kind of consultant former head of Elections Canada, which a lot of this is based on his report, stated that he did not think the bill was sound. Well, the Harper government said he did not represent his own opinion. What the fuck? Let me state that more clearly. The most partisan MP, in this case, Pierre Poilievre, was given the job of remodeling how we vote. He consulted no one. He just made it up as he saw fit. And that fit was good for the Conservative Party. Irrespective of whether this was by intent or not, it is broadly recognized that this is not fair to the other political parties or the voting public. Now, as I've already mentioned some of the pitfalls for this legislation, you, the humble but skeptical listener, may have thought this my own partisan position. Well, in the last week, an open letter has been sent to Harper, signed by 19 global scholars who specialize in the mechanics of elections. This was after a similar letter was sent from 180 Canadian academics. So what did they have to say? Let's run down the list. 1. Severely limiting the ability of the Chief Elections Officer, CEO, to communicate with the public, thereby preventing the CEO from encouraging voting and civic participation and publishing research reports. What this means is that the person who is in charge of our elections cannot, under any circumstance, actually try and promote voting. It would be like telling the Minister of Health that he could tell people where hospitals were, but he couldn't tell them how to actually be safer. It has been on this point that much praise has been given to Canada. It seems an anomaly to have a nonpartisan part of the government whose job it is, well, is to promote voting. The purported reason is that voter turnout is down. So the best way to increase voting is to stop trying to get people to vote? Maybe Harper thinks the election officer is suppressing the vote, much like what this bill will do. It is funny. I just read an article that stressed the importance of young voters this next election. It pointed out that if the number of under 30-somethings voted at the same rate as the general population, 60%, instead of their poor 40% turnout, well, not only would the election turned out very differently, the entire political debate would have changed. How different? Well, Harper would not have had his majority, and it's possible he would not have been PM. The issues would have been more progressive and positive. In polling, the PCs rank consistently third at about 18%. It seems for some, the older they get, the more they become cynical and small-c conservative, which I guess makes them, you know, Harper conservatives. Similar polling shows that Harper gets about 50% of the senior vote. 2. removing the enforcement arm of the agency, the Commissioner of Elections, from Elections Canada and placing it in the office of the Director of Public Prosecutions, a government department. Now, this may not sound like nothing more than a shifting of offices, but one thing does change. Today, the Elections Commissioner is accountable and responsible to Parliament as a whole. By shifting the extremely important enforcement arm to the DPP, you now have made them accountable not to Parliament, but to a government minister, which, as we know and have seen many times, does not act as Canada's government, but as Harper's government. This will bring into question items such as the true independence, the freedom of action, what items are pursued. It politicizes what currently is an apolitical position. Number three, prohibiting the commissioner from communicating with the public about the details of any investigation. And four, preventing any details from the commissioner's investigation from being included in the DPP's annual report on the commissioner's activities, a report that the DPP generates and gives to the Attorney General, and which the Attorney General then forwards to Parliament. Now I'm going to take these two together. By putting elections investigations into a quarantine from the public, it prevents the public from providing evidence. Think about how the RCMP will ask people about leads in a case. Well, that would be prohibited. Further, it precludes the people of Canada from knowing what the state of our democracy is. Many investigations lead to probable but not definitive culprits. Think about the robocall scandal that pointed strongly at a conservative plot but could not clinch the deal. Then again, perhaps it's things like that, proper paperwork for campaign financing, and the numerous other irregularities that have implicated the Conservatives that is at the root of this, quote, improvement. 5. Failing to provide the Commissioner with the power to compel witness testimony, a significant obstacle in a recent investigation in electoral fraud, which of course they mean the robocall scandal. If the intent was to really give Elections Canada teeth when it comes to stopping election fraud and other shenanigans, they would have provided the commissioner with the power to compel. One of the reasons a number of investigations have gone nowhere is because people have clammed up. This power would force people to testify. Now, I know a number of you might say that this is unconstitutional. Well, first, it's a gray area whether such testimony would be self-incriminatory. Many times, the information is sought about others or institutions. Secondly, in Canada, we have opted for a rights with limitations approach. So if the greater good outweighs the impact of the infringement, then the rights can be limited. Now, so far, we've only talked about Elections Canada itself, but this bill will also impact citizens. So, 6, prohibiting the use of voter information cards to establish a citizen's identity or residence. Now, this one surprised me. As I mentioned in the past, I've been an election officer in federal and provincial elections. Neither allowed the use of the card as a form of proof of residency or identity. I have since learned that as part of a pilot project, Elections Canada experimented using the card in selective districts. The agency allowed students, on-reserve First Nation voters, and people in long-term care facilities, many of whom who don't have a driver's license or any other proof of residence, to use the card to provide their address. People who would find it difficult to supply other forms of identification. Note here, I could not find out whether this was used to prove residency, identification, or both. Apparently, this allowed 400,000 Canadians to vote. If we reference the earlier part about the decline of voter turnout, this would seem a good thing. It should be noted that the allowable proof of residency is really any original piece of mail you got with your address on it. So this seems better than most, and if not by much. 7. Prohibiting the use of vouching to establish citizens' eligibility to vote. Currently, it is believed about 100,000 plus people vote without presenting any form of ID at all. They are allowed to vote because they have someone who does qualify as a legal voter to vouch for them. This requires the taking of an oath, and you can only vouch for one person. This is usually done when children of the elderly take their parents to vote. Those who have just turned 18 are spouses who usually have left their wallet or purse at home and thus don't have their papers with them. Now, on the one hand, this does sound like something a concerted conspiracy could use to shift an election.
But again, from experience, I can tell you that vouching is rarely used. Granted, 100,000 sounds like a lot, but it accounts for only about 0.2% of the votes cast. And no one has presented evidence, assuming 100% fraud, that it's ever shifted an election. In fact, this leads to a very weird conversation on the CBC's The Current, where they were interviewing Pierre Poilievre, who said at first that in about 45,000 of these cases, the paperwork was not perfect. To the host's praise, she pointed out that the report from which the numbers came stated that there were only irregularities, clerical errors, and not fraud. Poilievre then pointed out that Elections Canada reported over 55,000 irregularities regarding voter vouching in 2013, which I find weird. I cannot find any documentation supporting this, and there were only by-elections in 2013 and 2012, so where this number comes from, I am suspect. Later, he then conflates a, quote, 165,000 irregularities. Note how the number keeps getting bigger and bigger? Now, from my experience, many of these irregularities are clerical, forgetting to complete the oath form or similarly. But is this the best way to prevent clerical errors that have yet to produce any real election fraud? Is this reason to limit the chief election officer's power? No. You would think that the 100,000 plus Canadians deserve the right to vote. Remember their anxiety about a minority of citizens concerned when it came to the mandatory long-form census? Well, then it was every citizen must be afforded the maximal liberty. But when it comes to democracy and voters that are not likely to be conservatives, well, feck you. As a skeptic constantly vigilant about woo science, if you hear Poilievre quote mining Neufeld's report about the state of voting, well, it's funny in a, well, not really funny way. On a side note, for those who are unfamiliar with the term quote mining, something skeptics are all too well aware of, it is the deceitful tactic of taking quotes out of context in order to make them seemingly agree with the quote miner's viewpoint, or to make the comments of the opponent seem more extreme in order to make their position easier to refute or demonize. I use the term because Neufeld has come out this week stating that what the government said he said was not what he said. It's interesting, in the few cases where vouching irregularities did play a role, that is, when a win is counted in tens and the number of voucher irregularities were greater, well, the court disallowed the vote, thus nullifying any ill intent, if there was any, it showed that the system worked. So even then, there's no problem. In cases where the margin of victory is small, all this paperwork is hauled out. If there are errors on the part of the polling officer, they're dealt with. So the minister points to Etobicoke Centre, which showed the system actually worked. Those voters whose paperwork did not stand up to the scrutiny were disavowed and the elections were deemed legal. So has there ever been a case of voter fraud? Yes, I'm sure there has been. But enough to change an election? None has yet ever been provided for, irrespective of the frantic arm-waving of Pierre Poilievre. Let's get back to our list. Number 8. Exempting fundraising expenses from the spending limits of political party, thereby creating a potential loophole in weakening enforcement. By exempting fundraising expenses, communications with electors who previously donated over $20 to the party, from campaign spending, creates a bias in favor of parties with longer lists of donors above the threshold, currently the governing party. And what qualifies as fundraising advertising versus campaign advertising? If every ad had a request for a donation, could this make all advertising outside the spending limits? We have seen how unlimited money has perverted the democratic process south of the border. We don't need it here. Number 9. Failing to require that political parties provide supporting documentation for their expenses, even though the parties are reimbursed for over $30 million after every election. Again, if the real purpose of the Fair Election Act was to improve democracy, you would think they would take a lesson from the Yanks and make parties more accountable, but alas, tis not to be. Like the powers to compel testimony, the requirement to provide appropriate expense documentation would improve the system. Unless, of course, you're a conservative party that has been convicted of an in-and-out scandal, among other things. Number 10. Increasing the cap of individual donations from $1,200 to $1,500 per calendar year. As I mentioned in a previous show, This favors the conservatives by a 2-to-1 margin over the liberals and almost 10-to-1 over the official opposition, the NDP. Hardly seems unbiased to me. Number 11. Increasing the cap on individual contributions to their own campaigns from $1,200 to $5,000 per election from candidates and $25,000 per election from leadership contestants. This is creating a gap between the allowable campaign contributions of ordinary citizens and the contributions of candidates to their own campaigns, and thus increasing the influence of persons of wealth on election. That is, if I have a lot more money, I am more likely to be elected because I can spend more on my campaign than perhaps the average Joe. Again, it's an echoing of what goes on in the South. Enabling the winning political party to recommend names for poll supervisors, thereby politicizing the electoral process and introducing the possibility of partisan bias. So, when I was appointed as polling officer, it was done by the elections officer. This wording implies that the political parties will be the ones who will be selecting who runs the polling stations. If we look south of the border, there has often been partisan officials running the election apparatus. Well, it seems to be askew. Not sure what I mean? Well, just research Florida and the 2000 election. Neufeld, the one the government goes to as their, quote, consultant, although he wasn't actually consulted, they just based a lot of what they did on his report. Well, Neufeld said that it's an unlevel playing field. It makes people wonder whether the process is really being administered in a completely neutral way. 13. The substance of the Fair Election Act raises significant concerns with respect to the future of the electoral integrity in Canada. The process by which the proposed act is being rushed into law in Parliament has also sparked considerable concern. The governing political party has used its majority power to cut off debate and discussion in an effort to enact the bill as soon as possible. By contrast, the conventional approach to reforming an electoral apparatus in Canada has always involved widespread consultation with Elections Canada, the opposition parties, and the citizens at large, as well as the international community. Of course, that was when it was the government of Canada and not Harper's government. The flagrant disregard for our democratic traditions and processes is shocking, but not unique. Harper has mirrored the same practices the now ex-president of the Ukraine did. Get elected democratically, then rule as a dictator, while ensuring the next election is not so democratic. Again, to quote Mr. Neufeld, who said, "To me, it appears like they're trying to tilt the playing field in one direction. Their direction." Andrew Reynolds, an associate professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and one of the signatories to this open letter, stated that the Conservative government is trying to change Canadian electoral laws in a way that is deeply disturbing and sends a very poor message to countries trying to become democracies. Here's what he had to say on the subject in a recent interview.
I think Elections Canada is the preeminent example of a successful elections administration body. So it's not just important to Canada, but the rest of the world sort of sees Elections Canada as a role model. So its autonomy, its independence, its capacity to enforce free and fair elections is something that is transported around the world. Now, this legislation would severely do damage to the autonomy, to the independence, to the capacity of Elections Canada to manage good elections. Mm-hmm. The principle of any election in a democracy is to facilitate as many people who are legitimate voters to be able to vote on a given day. There's almost no evidence to show that vouching is a window to voter fraud. There's huge evidence to show that vouching would, if it was taken away, curtail the rights and accessibility of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Canadians to vote. So you're looking at a balance sheet between no evidence of fraud versus considerable evidence that taking away vouching would preclude legitimate voters from voting. And so I think that's the issue. It's about what is driving this proposal. Is it really fear of fraud and malfeasance, or it is in fact a partisan mechanism to try and preclude some people from voting who should be legitimately voting?
So you think it's about tilting the balance in favor of the governing party?
In every case that we've seen a similar type of proposal, it has been about tilting the balance in favor of a given party, just as it has been in the United States.
What depresses me most is that the experts are upset about this. The media seems to be ensuring that people know about this. I can't really complain about the coverage. And the opposition party is trying to put a stop to it. But something is missing. And that's you. Why are there not protests in the streets? How many of you have emailed your local MP to express your deep concerns that we are losing our democracy? That Harper and his conservative party cannot rule this country like some dictatorship? I'm going to put a few links in the show notes to try to help you get involved. Never forget, 2015, there will be a reckoning. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond me.
Wake up, dear circumstance.
Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.